92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hi, I'm Robert Hilburn, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology. Have a great day.
Welcome to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, a Pantheon podcast. Look inside the, let the sound take you away. Music.
Girl, we couldn't get much higher.
Culture. Conversation.
Hey, the tambourine man, play a song for me.
And good old-fashioned rock and roll.
Excuse me while I kiss this.
So now, I give you Miss Pamela and her pajama party.
Hello there, dolls. Come on in. And welcome again to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, a Pantheon podcast. You're about to kick back and relax. Don't think about anything else. With me, the world's most famous groupie. And I love that title because all it means to me is love. And love of music. The people who make it. And just wanting to be around that energy. And of course, I had my own band, the GTOs, Girls Together Outrageously. And today, again, I am welcoming one of my best girlfriends. She's right up there, Miss Mercy Fontenot of the GTOs. And by the way, I've written a few books, several books. You can actually find all my stuff on Amazon, and I have a website, PamelaDeBar.com, and you can find out about my writing workshops that I give all over the world and my rock and roll tours. And I even have clothes that I'm going to present soon, the groupie line. So wait for it. And I'm really excited and happy to be part of the Pantheon Podcast network of rock and roll shows. You can find all of our Pantheon shows on Spotify, Radio.com, Pandora, all those places, all those platforms. And we have about 40 different podcast distribution platforms these days. We are really growing. And we love telling the stories about the great moments in rock and roll history in all kinds of ways. There's something for everybody. So many shows, so many flavors to choose from. You can find it all at PantheonPodcast.com. And I'm going to have new announcements at the top of every Miss Pamela DeBar's Pajama. You know, we just changed the name. It used to be Miss Pamela's Pajama Party. And I thought, you know what? People know me by my name, Pamela DeBar. So I suggested, let's call it Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party. I hope you like that tag because that was my decision. And finally, this is the one that matters the most to us. If you enjoy what we do here, please tell your friends so they will go to PantheonPodcast.com and listen to all of our fabulous DJs.
Lighting up, I'm standing there, roses held by him. Tried to catch Keely-da-da-doo, but the circle would not permit it. This circular circulation, I circle continuously.
And today, like I said, I have the fabulous Miss Mercy of the GTOs, and she has so many interesting stories to tell. Our last podcast, we talked mainly about the GTOs and our amazing time with Zappa and all that. I'm going to ask her a lot of questions today about her life, and then we're going to, you know, segue a little into Graham Parsons, who was really important to both of us. So please, let's welcome Miss Mercy today.
With the log cabin as the central hub of activity for the marginal figures of the Los Angeles freak scene, Zappa didn't so much have to search for the right artists to document on his label, but instead simply wait for them to turn up. With Wildman Fisher already on the books, the next act to fascinate him was a group of dancers, already established on the downtown scene, who would, over time, become the GTOs.
The intentions of the GTOs were basically to be a girls group without real vocal training, and to also get some of the cutest guys possible. That's my opinion of what it was. It was also a girl thing. One of the first, you know, before the Spice Girls or any of that, it was a girl thing.
And these girls weren't simply drawn to each other through their dancing. Various members of the GTOs had first encountered each other on the Sunset Strip as part of the flourishing groupie scene. And although women seeking sexual intimacy with the famous and the powerful was not a new phenomenon, since the British invasion exploded on American shores in the mid-60s, a subculture had quickly begun to develop.
Hello, dolls. Like I said, I am here with my beloved Miss Mercy.
Your other half?
My
that
other
was
half.
The sweetest thing in the world that you said.
Well, I really believe that, and I feel that. And you know, look what I'm wearing today.
I gave you that.
Yes, you did. It's a friendship necklace.
It is. It is.
She gets me the sweetest things because we are madly in love, right?
Yes, we are.
Okay, good. Well, anyway, this is my second bout with Miss Mercy here on Pamela DeBar's podcast. And we're going to talk about some things we didn't get to talk about last time. We mainly spoke about the GTOs last time.
Okay.
And so this time I want to talk about, you know, your history. You know, when did you start getting into rock and roll in a huge way?
My mother was into it in the 50s. She was had all the Sun records and just traveling because my father was a gambler and he was always getting cement shoes promised to him. Anyway,
cement shoes, for those of you who didn't quite understand that. Cement shoes promised to him.
He gambled a lot and owed a lot of money, so we went where every racetrack was, and all over from Florida to Dallas to Seattle to San Mateo, I keep going back to. There was always a racetrack there, here, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would hear all sorts of music, actually country roots and blues things and all that stuff. It wasn't even rock and roll. It was basically music, so.
All kinds.
All kinds.
But when you hit,
even
like,
that terrible stuff, that awful stuff like Lawrence Welk.
Okay. Yeah, that was pretty awful.
It was really terrible. Or your Hit Parade. How about your Hit Parade?
Your Hit Parade wasn't too bad. There were some decent things on that.
Like
once
what?
In a while.
Name me one.
Well, how much is that doggy in the window?
That's
how much is
I
that
I know what
doggy
you're saying. That's Patty Page or who was it?
It was cute.
Okay.
She doesn't like it. Okay. So,
I'm going to try to hear Walking the Dog. Or Rufus Thomas. Thank you.
I know you would. That was a good segue, Mercy, from Doggy in the Window to Walking the Dog.
Well,
great. You have segue.
What does that mean? Like, never mind. I know what it means. I get it. Okay.
Okay. So, when you were like 15 or so, though, something changed, right?
No, 12. 12.
12? What happened at 12?
The Tammy Show? How old was I when the Tammy Show was
No, you
out?
Were about 15. That's why.
Well, the Tammy.
Yeah.
But I was almost, you know, it's very confusing about my life because at 15, I was also in Haight-Ashbury. So I was almost in Haight-Ashbury then.
Yeah.
So it must have been the end of 15.
Okay.
And that must have been the beginning of 15.
Yes.
When the Tammy Show came out.
Yes, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that changed my life.
T-A-M-I. It's a documentary.
American music something.
I don't know what it all means either.
Amazing show. Yeah. That blended everybody from the Stones to the Animals to the Jan and Dean on their sidewalk surfing, which were really skateboards.
They were hosting.
Yep,
yeah.
They were.
It's an incredible show. You can find
it on
YouTube.
James Brown was so great on that show that the Stones didn't even want to follow him. But it had so many different people on that show. It was just, I don't even know how it was allowed to get out because it was an interracial thing. And at that time, things were very racial.
Yeah, I know. It's a very important thing. And I remember it real well, too, of course, because I was a Stones freak, of course.
Well, yes.
We spoke a lot about them on the last time we had this wonderful experience together.
Yes, we did.
So after that, okay, when did you actually decide, okay, I want to meet the people playing this music?
Oh, God. It just, you know, there was Tom Donahue at KYA
San Francisco?
Well, he was in San Francisco. I was in San Mateo.
Okay.
But the Bo Brummels came to town, and so I went and followed them. And also, you have to realize that Tom Donahue started FM radio.
Oh,
he did. He was the inventor of FM radio.
And he was your favorite DJ you listened to?
Well, no. Sly Stone was on K-Soul at the same time, and they were friends.
Wow, yeah. Cool.
That was nutty.
So, but, okay, what made, you know, people always want to know, what is a groupie, really? And how does it begin, you groupied them? So, for some reason, you decided, okay, I'm going to meet the Bo Brummels. I mean, what made you think you could do that?
No, actually, I didn't decide that. They actually walked into a restaurant while I was there with my mother at the mall, and there they came walking in.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How'd you know it was them?
Well, you couldn't help but know it was them. Nobody looked like that in San Mateo.
Okay. So, and
that was Tom Donahue's group, by the way.
What do you mean that was his group?
He made the Bo Brummels. Oh, it's his group. God, it's kind of like the Simon of, you know, he made that group.
I know nothing about Tom Donahue.
Oh, my God.
That's fascinating.
People need to know about Tom Donahue. He was a big, very heavy set dude. But he's a beginner. Look it up. FM radio. He's the one that started it.
Okay. So you were lucky to be able to hear that young.
Yes, I was. When he started putting on those long albums.
Yeah, but
he broke the mold.
I want to go back to the Bo Brummels. So when you saw them walk in the mall having lunch with your mom, what did you...
They weren't having lunch with my mom. I was having
no,
lunch.
No, I know. Did you say, okay, mom, I want to go meet those guys?
No, I don't know. I don't even know if I met them, but I did. They came back and I got in trouble because I was underage, for being at their gig. I remember that.
Mm.
They played San Mateo.
And how'd you meet them?
I just followed John around. He was a drummer. Peterson.
Wow.
I used to have a photo of him, but I lost it.
You followed him around.
Yeah. And then I got in trouble for being, you know, underage and couldn't follow him around anymore.
Okay. And what happened next? I mean, okay, that gave you a taste.
Oh, I followed the Stones to Sacramento with my high school girlfriends. I must have been 15. That is the one where... We were in Sacramento when Keith got electrocuted.
Oh, wow.
No, it's true.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
True.
I remember
they were
that.
Playing with Patty and the Bluebells, and I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man out and Over the Rainbow. I love I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man because I really did. But anyway.
Okay.
So anyway, I was with one of my high school friends had moved up there with her family. And so we were in a car.
Moved up where?
Sacramento.
Oh, okay, Sacramento. You went
Sorry
to meet them. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, so we went to the Stones concert, and then suddenly Keith gets electrocuted and goes like 5 feet up off the ground. And
you witnessed that?
Yeah, I saw that.
Wow.
And they shut the curtain. So I said, let's go. So we all jammed out of there and got in the car. And the car came out of the garage, underneath the garage, I believe. And we followed that car, which had the Stones in it. We followed the Stones down the freeway and everything. Then they stopped at a gas station and changed into another car. And we followed that car. And it came to a little bungalow hotel and motel. And we got out and we passed where Mick was. And you could hear him kind of like pacing and really upset about Keith. Of course, Keith was in the hands of the ambulance and police. I have heard stories.
Wow.
I have heard rumors. I'm not going to verify them because I wasn't there, that they beat him up. I'm not sure.
Who beat him up?
Police. I'm not
Keith?
Sure. Yeah.
Really? That was.
I'm not sure, but there was rumors. Huh. That's what they did.
Wow.
It might have, you know, because the Stones probably were a big threat to him.
Yeah.
So then we went to this other room, which happened to be Brian Jones' room, knocked on the door. The door was open, so we just walked in. I think there were three of us. And he was going through his suitcase, looking at clothes. And at that time, I wasn't really interested in sex. Not that I was really ever interested in sex anyway. But anyway.
I know.
So,
I know that about you.
Well, for a few times it happened. But that was good. Anyway. So he was there going through his suitcases. And Charlie Watts is in there because he had lost his key or didn't have his key to get his apartment. And we just sat there and just watch them. And, you know, Brian Jones is one of my favorite in the world. Oh, my God.
Was he, okay, at that point, were you a fanatic of his like you became later? Or did that help create that?
I was in awe being in there, kind of, you know, seriously. But it wasn't
for sure.
It wasn't in as awe that I would have been probably a little later.
Okay.
In other words, it just was cool. You know, it was just kind of cool. So then we got up, and he didn't ask us to leave, I don't think. But we left, and that was one of my first encounters.
Yeah, well, so you hung out with Brian and Charlie at age 15.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
This has got to be before all this stuff happened.
I remember when I first tried to meet the Stones, I was 16. So it was the second time they came to America, I believe. And I went with Victor to the Ambassador Hotel. And and... I was trying to meet Mick, of course, but Captain Beefheart, you know, Victor's cousin, took us to meet Bill and Charlie. So we hung out with Bill and Charlie, and we were listening to, I was listening to blues for the very first time. I'd never heard it. And I was like, wow, okay. And I was nodding my head, looking around, seeing, okay, everyone's nodding their heads. And I thought, I better nod my head. We were just kids,
it's
right?
So sorry, because I never really realized who Captain Beefheart was, and I would have been right there.
I know. Anyway, I tried to meet Mick, and all that long story's in the book. But I also was very curious about Brian Jones, because he was so beautiful. But when I encountered him in passing, he wasn't very nice. So I just waited around and just tried to see what they were doing in all these little bungalows in the Ambassador. And at one point, some little teenage girls finally got up the nerve to knock on Brian's door. And when he opened the door, he was in his underwear and some cowboy boots.
I didn't even heard this one. This one's good.
And he was
God,
and he was holding a broom in his hand. No, I can still see this so vividly. You know, some things you never forget,
I know,
right?
You never told me this. This is very interesting.
And he said, if you girls don't leave me alone, I'm going to drag you in here and fuck you. He said that to these teenage girls in his underwear and cowboy boots holding a broom.
Well, he just wanted to get rid of you.
So then later, I said, okay, this is interesting. So I went around the back and peeked in his window to see what he was doing in there. And he had two very scantily clad Hispanic girls in there with him.
Probably
and he
the
was
maids.
Frolicking with
probably
them.
Probably the darn maids.
He was having fun. Okay. So, yeah, he was pretty wild, I think. And he was your favorite. You even wrote a diary. Your diary was called Marigold, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That did to him, yes. And he's also in my song, I Have a Paintbrush in My Hand, A Color of Triangle, which is Lowell George did the music. But it is actually about a fantasy trip between my boyfriend, Bernardo, and Brian and me.
Yeah, it was a triangle.
Yeah, but it was a real.
It was an imaginary,
yes, it was.
Fabulous triangle.
Yes, it was.
Now, Bernardo.
No, really, because I would have never done a three-way anyway. But
Bernardo was a BTO. We used to call the boys together outrageously. And we danced with them. Carlos, Bernardo, a kid, redhead named Wednesday, and yeah. Obie, who is now Marlo. And so did you and Bernardo have sexual relations?
Much later.
Much later? But you did, huh?
Finally, yeah. But he was not even my boyfriend anymore. I don't know what... I was in San Francisco. I don't know how that happened. It was very strange. But, you know, talking about the BTOs, there's one, yes, that had an exclusive story. Well, Bernardo was like Haight-Ashbury's king. I mean, everybody loved Bernardo.
He was
like
he
Cleopatra.
Was a beauty,
he was insanely beautiful.
What was his last name?
Saldana.
Oh, yeah.
But there was another interesting guy, Carlos Lorenzo, mm-hmm, who became actually, I went with him to his mother's house. And the they were after him to get in. They just missed him. The people who draft people, those people.
Oh,
whatever. And they so he had to run. He had to leave. He had to get the heck out of there. So he goes to New York, and ends up in the Living Theater, which was a incredible theater that was very underground and very famous.
Yeah,
infamous.
Theater, yeah, I remember.
Let me go that way. And he goes to Paris.
Correct.
So in Paris, here's Salvador Dali.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at him, And I guess he said, I want him.
He was the most beautiful boy ever.
I had sex with him, too.
You did?
Amazing, isn't it?
How was that?
It was the same. It's always the same to me most of the time. But anyway, it was nice. Kind of hard to have sex with friends. Anyway, so
yeah, I guess so. Those are the days.
The incredible thing is that about him is that Dolly went and got him, and he became with Dolly for the rest of his life.
Yeah,
if you can imagine, with Salvador Dolly,
he was a model.
Yeah. He's in a lot of his things.
Well, he was also his assistant.
Exactly, assistant for getting his voyeur couples.
He's
assistant to the estate too.
Yeah, he was. He wound up, you know, after Dolly died, he took care of that estate.
No, I saw
him
on TV. And I said, "Who the heck is that?" Oh my God, he was so different. Oh my God, he was like so together. Anyway,
yes, he was. And I saw him during that time. He came to visit me probably in the.
I mean, you told me
early '80s or something, and it was amazing to see him again. He was my favorite BTO. I loved them all, but wow, God, I just loved Carlos.
Yeah, Carlos was very beautiful. So anyway, he's like in those pictures that Dolly drew. The male. I think he was the one on the cross. That beautiful guy is him. So then he wrote a book called "Sex," Salvador Dolly and Me.
Yeah,
but he died. He's dead.
Yeah, Carlos died too young. Yeah, and Bernardo's gone too.
Bernardo, it was a sad story. Bernardo had AIDS, and he actually was tied up by, because there's a lot of crack at this time. I was addicted to crack. He got back on crack, and he they might have been crack friends, or it might have been home invasion, but they tied him up. And he escaped and went off the second story where he lived and hit one of his main organs on
the fire hydrant?
No, water things with the power. The water power. Anyway.
Okay. He hit himself on something going down.
Right.
Okay. And he was never the same.
No, he was dead. Okay.
Oh.
No, wait a minute.
I thought he also fell out of a window and broke every bone in his body and lived.
Before. I had two.
Oh my God.
Wait a minute. There's two boyfriends of mine.
Yes.
That fell six stories. Bernardo did that in San Francisco much earlier.
Oh, but didn't he break every bone in his body?
Probably.
Something?
I don't
know. That's what I heard.
Most of them probably shattered. And then I think, who was the other one that fell out the window? I think it was Arthur Lee. I'm not sure.
Arthur Lee also fell out a window?
I think he
okay,
did.
Okay, let's talk about
I'm
Arthur.
I'm not positive. If you know anything different, right, Pamela?
let's talk about Arthur. How did you meet him? You met him way after Love was big and famous, correct?
No, not exactly. I met Arthur Lee about 1969. I was friends with Miss Devin Wilson, who is actually Dolly Dagger.
Correct.
Who came here, supposedly, that was sent here by Keith Richards to show up at my doorstep. And I don't know what Marlo's trip is with all his stuff, but I know what happened. And so this confliction is going to go on. It doesn't matter.
Yep, doesn't matter.
I remember this intently. I was like, suddenly there's a knock at the door. I look outside. There's a taxi outside. This is when I lived with Marlo and Miss Christine, or Ricky. I think Ricky was there.
On La Brea?
Exactly.
Correct.
So, at my door is one beautiful black girl and one Spanish girl, I believe, which was Eric Burden's wife, Angie. And she goes, Keith Richards sent me to your house. We got to go find Graham Parsons. I need to get high.
Okay.
This is true. And she had, Jimmy was dead, and she had his wardrobe, and she hung it in my house. Okay. We would, like, hitchhike around, and she was Quincy Jones. She was staying at Quincy Jones's house. And
we're talking about Devin Wilson now.
Yes, this is
Dolly
Devin.
Dagger,
yeah,
yes.
I'm sorry.
I knew her, too.
I know, she sold
scared
your stuff.
Me.
Okay,
she
all right.
Scared
but
me.
We were friends. In fact, one time we got picked up by John. Actually, on the way to Graham's to get some heroin, we got picked up by John Astin of the Addams Family. And we smoked pot with him. I remember that night. It's really true. I'm not. This
is
a real
fabulous.
True story. It was.
I don't remember that.
Well, you weren't there.
No, but I mean, I don't remember you telling me that.
Well, I'm telling you now. I totally remember that night.
Okay.
So we go over there and we find Graham and we do heroin. Everything goes fine, and I hang out with Devin for a little bit.
Everything goes fine. That's just incredible.
Well, luckily, because people die on that shit. You know, that's what I meant. Everything went fine. And I don't know her story, because Devin's very, very famous for being a liar.
Yes. Exaggerator.
Exaggerator, whatever. And so whether or not Keith sent her there, I don't know, but I don't know how she knew where I lived or what the real true story was. It could be possible because Keith and Graham were best friends.
Yes,
I don't
they
know.
Were.
So that's that.
I think it was 1970, though, not in 69. Because Jimmy
really sure.
died in 1970.
Well, then it was 1970.
Yes,
sorry.
That's okay.
My ears are a little
that's
bungled.
That's okay. And I remember this story about Graham, because one time, Graham Parsons was a very dear friend of ours. For some reason, he took a shine to Mercy and I. Very odd, since he was from the South, and you wouldn't think that he would latch on to a couple of nuts in the GTOs, but he did. Well, we latched on to him, too. I mean, right?
Well, you latched first.
Well,
you found it first.
Well, no. Well, you and I spotted him first.
No,
together.
You knew about him because of the birds.
Yeah. Well, I knew about him because of the birds. Yes, but we saw him together at the premiere of the Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, you think
and
it was
we
that?
We said, "Who is that?"
And I think it was you. Are what you you are what
I
you
already,
eat. That's
oh,
what
really?
I always thought. But we have a different.
I know.
But it's okay
interesting.
Because he had a Yellow Submarine. But he doesn't have a Yellow Submarine suit. I've seen it.
No,
and it's
he
not
does.
Yellow.
Nope. Oh, no, it's red with yellow submarines. Oh,
okay.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it, too.
Fine over nudie suits.
In fact,
suits.
An old friend of mine owns that jacket.
Nudie Cohen, we're talking about, who he just
nudie.
Adored.
Nudie.
She worked for him, but
nudie
he hit on
suits.
Her.
Yeah, he hit on me. He chased me around. Nudie chased me around. I worked there for 1 week. And more than anything, I wanted a nudie suit. So
God, I wanted a nudie belt. It was...
I know, we wanted his stuff. It was so expensive, though. So I was working there for a short time, and he chased me around. He used to have saddles in his dressing rooms so people could, I don't know why they had saddles in his dressing rooms, but he chased me around the saddle. I mean, it was just an incredible thing. It actually occurred that Nudie chased me around these saddles. And his wife, Bobby, also worked there, and she fired me because of it. And he offered me a suit. He said, design your own suit. You know, you can have stars. I wanted stars and moons and everything on a nudie suit, a mini dress version. But then he said I had to spend half an hour with him alone for that suit.
I think I would have done that.
Really? Mercy.
Why not?
Well, I didn't. So I never got my nudie suit. But anyway.
But he would ask me. Anyway.
So you and I got into Graham together. And then we started hanging out with Graham.
And we both freaked out.
This is before Mercy shot heroin with him. And this is early 69. No, late 68. We started hanging out with him.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and...
when did the GTOs break up? I don't even know.
We didn't, I mean, we tried to keep it going for so long. Remember?
No, but I mean, what year did we really break up? Because I went to Memphis. I don't think I was still in the GTOs in 1971, 70.
Well, you were.
Oh, my God.
We were still trying to make it happen. Remember, Miss Christine was with Albert Grossman, of all things.
Well, I would be with Albert Grossman, too. I mean, that's a smart move.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, she was. And we were supposed to go on the road with Todd Rundgren, remember? And that was probably
exactly.
70.
I wouldn't visit her with Todd. And
yeah.
We went to actually the Woodstock, not the crazy festival that I really have no regards for and did not go. I don't
okay.
think it's fabulous. I think it's capitalistic nightmare. Anyway, I'm not a big fan of that at all. But Monterey Pop, yes. Wattsax, yes. Okay. But I hitchhiked. Because she was living with Todd.
Yes, that was her boyfriend before Albert Grossman.
Well, she Miss Christine had foresight that was unbelievable.
Yeah, she did. She did.
And she had Iggy, and she had all these. She
was amazing.
Arthur Brown. She had a lineup. I mean,
we
she was real
GTOs.
Smart. I was smart. She was smart at finding things, the people.
We had very good taste in music. Let's put it that way.
No, we had actually we had four whatever it is.
insight, foresight?
Foresight about finding people who are going to be
there. Oh, yeah, for sure. And I still have make that. It. I still have that kind of foresight, I think.
So I hitchhiked over. He was recording, believe you're going to believe this or not. He was doing stage fright with the band. I guess it must have been the Big Pink House. I'm not really sure, but that's where I was. And I'm sitting there with Rick Danko, who I got a crush on later after he was dead. trying to give him lyrics to Stage Fright because he didn't have them all yet.
Now, what is Stage Fright?
It's a huge album by the band.
Oh, really?
The man with the stage fright trying to give him all his money.
Okay,
like
cool.
I can sing. All right. God, it was a really great. How many people really actually got to watch the band in their own? Very few.
No, you've been in the right place at the right time many times, Mercy.
I don't know why we got on that because of Todd. I'm just Albert. Yeah,
I know we're segueing again, but
it's all right.
We should go back to Graham. Okay, I'm sure you remember the night.
How can we get back there? How can we footstep back there? the band have absolutely nothing to do with Graham.
But. I don't know how we wound up talking about Miss Christine's fashion sense.
You talk about Albert Grossman.
Yes, I don't know. I'm sorry.
You know what? You have to follow us because we're a little bit screwy.
Yeah. We're going back to Graham. So remember how important country music was to him and how he tried to make everyone else understand how important Merle and George and Willie and all that were?
Well, not only that, actually, he was also way into rhythm and blues.
Yeah, he was for
and
sure.
He was really, yeah. But the one that I always bring up. Is when we were over there when they had those wagon wheels, half wagon wheels.
Yes,
when you went
in the
down.
Driveway on DeSoto here in Reseda.
That's when we first went over there, and then he was playing George Jones, and he was crying. I had a tear dropping out of his cane dropping. He had a tear drop out of his eye.
He wept over that music.
Oh, because he said, this is the King George Jones, the King of Broken Hearts, who I actually already liked because I've been through the South. And
yeah, I'd never heard of. I mean, I'd heard of him, but I was not
interested. I like Merle Haggard, too, and I like Marty Robbins. I liked all those people.
Well, for me, it was an amazing expansion because that I can never thank him enough for.
You'd have to have a country channel in L.A., which you did have, but you probably did not listen to
it. Yeah,
I
didn't
listen to rock and roll.
Yeah, I didn't even know about it, really, and Graham opened my heart and soul to country music and changed my life forever.
Well, he changed my life. He had a big influence. He was a big influence on my life. I love him.
We went to visit Graham in the hospital after his motorcycle accident. See, I don't think we were very close with him at one point.
Yes,
we were the only two people visiting
him
in the hospital.
There's something that you write about and you left me out.
What?
And I don't think you remember this. When he got that car, that Thunderbird.
Yeah.
He came and got both of us. And he took us to the Lafayette Cafe in Venice.
You remember the name of the cafe?
Yes.
Oh, my God, I've got to change that, and I'm with the band. I didn't remember
the
name.
And it was you and me, and he picked us up at
the
Landmark.
I know. I said it was you and me.
No, you didn't. You actually said he came and got me.
No.
Go read it again.
I'll read it again because I totally knew you.
We always have Mickey these Goffin verbal boxing gloves. Okay,
I know.
Her and I have verbal boxing gloves.
Wasn't Mickey Goffin with us, too?
Probably.
Mickey Goffin.
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
Before he almost killed him for... Yeah,
for
later.
Yeah, so we don't need to put that out there. That's none of your business, okay? No offense. We love you, but we can't expose everything that are personal to other people.
So yes, he took us to dinner.
He did the Lafayette on Venice Beach. Yes, I remember.
Wow, the Lafayette was a soul food place. Right?
Well, of course. It's Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yes, it was a soul food place, which doesn't exist anymore and hasn't for a long time. It was right on the beach.
Correct.
Wouldn't you love to just relive that night? And
well, we are right now. When you talk about it, we relive it.
No, I want to know what we said to Graham, what he said to us and all that. I miss him so much.
Probably said, let's get high. By that time, one of the first things he ever said to me is, I want to shoot heroin. And I looked at him like...
One of the first things he said to you? Where?
No, actually at his new house. When I went to visit him, you weren't there.
Well, that's not one of the first things he said to you.
In the new house.
Okay.
In the new house. He had a new house. I went with Johanna. Geez.
Okay.
We had a big crush on
him. Yes, I know.
Oh, I better be quiet about that. I'm just kidding. It doesn't matter.
No, he had a crush on him.
And I went up, and he was watching. You couldn't say anything if he was watching Hee Haw. You couldn't even open your mouth, okay? But when I walked into his other... It's true. It's really true.
Oh, Graham.
That's really true. I mean, he just hushed everybody up. Don't talk.
Well, it was really one of the only ways you could see any kind of country music.
Well, Hee Haw was actually quite good.
I know. There were some great people on it. George Jones was on it. Merle jokes, and everybody. But,
yeah. Think about it.
As long as you ignored Minnie Pearl, it was all right.
A redneck show.
Yeah, it was. But,
It was crossed over.
Great music, though.
But it crossed over.
Anyway, yes, you saw Graham, and he said, I want to shoot heroin.
Yeah. I said, don't look at me. At that point.
At that point. But then later, you went over there and did
do heroin. Yeah, well, you know, why not?
Didn't you tell me about the time that he almost died and you had to walk around, he had to put ice cubes up his bum?
You got that wrong, too. Okay, well, we're going to go on this Janis Joplin trip because this is where you're taking me.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's go.
Janis Joplin, whatever they say, OD'd at the place that we actually used to live with.
Yep.
With the GTO. It's called the Landmark.
Landmark Hotel.
Okay. When I was over on La Brea, like you're saying, in that house.
Yep. I remember it vividly.
We had the same connection. I mean, I would do heroin once in a while when I was bored. I couldn't get... Because getting meth was really hard here. Okay? In San Francisco, it was a breeze. L.A., unless I went to... I started going to the doctors to get it. Okay? My family doctor, anyway. But you could get it easily on the streets here. Or it's very hard to find. For us, on a lower level. I don't know if you're rich, you can get anything, but we weren't. So, wait a minute. Okay.
Yes.
George, who is the black dealer to Lucy and everybody.
Miss
Poochie. Lucy. Yeah, all of them.
Okay. All right. Chichi Connie. Yep.
He came over to my house after seeing Janis, and he said, I want you to test out this heroin, and I'm going to stay while you do it. So I tested it out, and I started to go down. I started to go down way too fast. So he shot me up with cocaine, and it brought me back up. And later that night, the news came over she was dead. Now, I think my opinion is that George got given some, because the chemist that he usually got it from was not there to test it. Okay. In the movie, they say that she got it from this guy, her old connection, who's white in the bio or whatever. But it was George, the black dude. Okay,
yeah.
I didn't want the stuff in my house, so I go give it to Graham for free. He gave it to me. He said, I don't want this stuff. And he gave it to me, and I gave it to Graham. Well, Graham did it. Nothing happened to him, but his Spanish friend or his Mexican friend did it, and OD'd. So he had to call Chuck Wine to come save his life. Chuck Wine, the director of Rainbow Bridge.
Our dear friend.
Our dear, dear friend. And that's really a true story. I don't know. Everybody's books seem to be wrong, or whatever they're saying seem to be wrong.
Do you have this in your book? This story in your book?
Yes.
Okay, Mercy has a book that's complete now, and it's going to pretty soon be released, right, Merce?
Well, I have the wonderful, incredible Lindsay Parker, Yahoo music editor that I met because of Pamela, really. I would see her on TV, and I would say, this girl's she's got something special about her. And then I would see her at Pamela's house.
My parties.
And it's not because she had bright red hair, either. I would see her, because she would tweak, main TV. She would tweak it. You know, like somebody that was, like when Leonard Cohen died, she actually stopped her role that she was supposed to be doing and reading the cards and just went, oh, no.
Aww.
You know, things, great things like that that were spontaneous. And she was always, so I said to her one day, I saw you on TV and we became friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there and somewhere we were out to eat. And I said, somebody said, oh, you should write a book. Because I keep seeing the same stories over and over and over. They spin around in my head. So I said, well, I don't really want to. And Lindsay pops up and says, I'll do it. This is 2 years ago.
Yep.
And I went, oh my God, look who this is. Wow. Well, okay, Lindsay. So we worked with her for 2 years when we could, because she's the busiest woman in the world.
Yep. She's real busy, but she did take the time.
Well, we did the interviews and she threw it all together because I'm really crazy. I mean, I'm not easy to follow. Like, you'll probably find out in this interview that I'm going on little trails and go off. I mean,
yes.
VH1 banned me because I was from, what was it?
Yes, it was called Let's Spend the Night Together.
Yeah, they're not, obviously, I could not stay
my
documentary on, track.
On groupies. And Mercy, of course, I wanted her in them, obviously, because she's in the book. But she couldn't stay on track.
I was
so
not.
They cut her out.
Yeah, which they lost a lot when they did that. Even though it would have been crazy, it would have been...
I agree that they lost a lot, of course.
Anyway,
I fought for you, you know.
So
that.
Why am I saying that? Here we go.
Here we go again. Okay.
Why was I saying that? Can you remember?
Yeah, we were talking about your book.
Oh yeah. So so we did interviews.
Oh boy.
We did interviews and interview. We would meet when we could, like on a Saturday and Sunday, and. We 2 years and we finally got it. She actually took all my ranting.
It's kind of a miracle that how she
took
put
my
it together.
And she got my voice.
Yeah, that's
and
really
she
incredible.
Actually, put the book together. So it's together, but it needs to, you know, be mocked up. And she's changing a few things. She's just like changing a few, something about Lucky. I mean, she's putting a few more things about Lucky.
She
should
okay.
be more in it.
Okay, good. And it's called Permanent Damage, right?
It's called Permanent Damage.
Now, Permanent Damage is also the name of the GTO's album.
Yes, and I thought that up when I was sitting there at a great big dining room table up in Laurel Canyon when Joe Bryant, my darling boyfriend Joe Bryant, who actually, I just saw Elton John's story yesterday, that crazy movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very bizarre movie. It wasn't as bad as Queen, but it was pretty strange. It was musical. But anyway.
Is Joe Bryant mentioned?
No, of course not.
Oh.
The thing is, nobody would ever talk about Joe Bryant. I heard, I don't know if it's true. And Lee Childers could not give me the answer, who used to work for him and is now gone. That they were made to sign a waiver when they worked for Bowie, that they have never heard that name. Because Joe Bryant, who was the first one to come out gay,
he was
an amazing
friend of ours.
They had more money behind them than anybody.
Incredible musician.
Absolutely. He was the second lead in Hair.
Yeah, that's how we met him. Mercy met him the night that Hair premiered in L.A.
Yeah, he came off the stage and grabbed me and threw me on stage.
Yes,
with him.
We all went up on stage. It was so
yeah,
great.
From that point on, I was basically with him. He was gay, and I never had sex, thank God, because he died of HIV. But Paul Morrissey is like one of the biggest fans of the world of him. I mean, you know. And so where am I going with this?
So no, you great. Have gone through so many trails.
What?
I can't remember what we were talking about.
Oh, Elton John. I remember.
Okay.
You said that he get mentioned in Elton John's movie. That's
okay.
What you asked
okay,
me.
But why were you talking about Elton John?
Why was I talking about? I don't know.
This is what happens. Oh, my God.
Well, yes, okay. What happens when you're senile. And when you're old, I don't know. When you've had a life that we led, you get kind of like...
Well, there's so many things that happened. Let's go back to Graham, shall we?
Okay.
So
hippity hop, get on the horse. What?
We saw the Burrito Brothers play.
Hey, that line.
More than any other people
minute,
ever
line.
Saw them.
And all the roads lead back to you. So now we can be on Graham.
Okay. Okay. So we spent more time at burrito shows than any other people. I think the only other person that saw more burrito shows than
Michelle?
I did. No. Was their road manager, Jimmy Sider. I mean, sometimes I would even go without you because I was so in love with Hillman, right?
Right.
I loved Graham to death, but I mean, I was in love with
You sure did love him to death because that's what happened.
Yeah, but it wasn't my fault.
I know. That's the only one that upset me. It was 1973.
Yeah.
And it really upset me.
It really upset me,
And the
me
strange
too.
Thing about that is, like, Michelle Myers called me from Warner Brothers and said, Graham's dead.
You
and
called
I,
me.
I know,
called
I called
me.
You after,
it's
and I
horrible.
Said, how in the heck does Warner Brothers know that Graham is dead?
Well,
strange to me.
Well, they find, insider people find that stuff out.
I'm sure they do.
I was sitting
I'm
in my little apartment.
Theorist. Everybody knows.
I was sitting in my little apartment in those Charlie Chaplin, you know, that crazy, wonderful place Charlie Chaplin built for
right,
his,
I remember that. That's where you, weren't you with Don?
Then?
No, you
there.
Were just with Mike then.
No, I wasn't with
yes.
anyone at that point.
I think
point.
Mike was appeared.
Michael?
Mike DeBars.
No, I met him in 74.
Okay.
January of 74. But on his birthday, actually. But no, I was sitting there making a shirt at you know, and the phone rang and you told me that. And it was so
just
sad.
Just broke my heart. Because the only one I really cared about that died, I mean, at that point.
Well, he had so much more to do. That's why I think his spirit is still so very much alive.
Well, no, he blew up, let's face it. And the funny thing is, if you think about it, he had an album cover that was different, but Gretchen would let that one come out. So they put him up in the air like he's going to heaven.
They
called the Grievous Angel. I'm going, this is a strange, this is 6 months after his death, I think.
Well, that was the name of a song that he wrote, though.
I understand, but they named the album that and his head's up in the clouds. Like what kind of strange thing. It was a very bizarre thing. And the last cut on that is In My Hour of Darkness. This is bizarre.
I know. I really believe he felt he had
and it wasn't on Bizarre Label.
A huge mission, you know. And I still try to continue that on my rock tours. I insist that people, I take them up to the Burrito Manor, where I used to hang out with them, and I insist that they listen to him. And if they haven't heard of him, I just regale them with every kind of story possible. We go to A&M, and I show them the place across the street that used to be a burrito stand, because the burritos didn't have a name for their band after Graham absconded with Hillman. And that's how they got the name, the Flying Burrito Brothers, because that's where they had lunch every day.
Right, because I remember the burrito.
So I take people there because people don't know these things. I think music history is so important, you know.
Well, I get that. Yes, they don't know anything. I mean, most of the stories that are right, most of the bios that are written on these people are made by the record companies, most of them, and they're not the truth. A lot of them are not really the truth. I mean, they just expound on things and make stuff up, and they're not really true.
Okay, well. Most That's why we're here. We're going to set the record straight.
I mean, you know, you have some really great writers. I mean, you could take, what is it, Robert Hilburn, or you could take, there's a lot of writers that were really great writers.
Yes, of course. Michael Gilmore.
Who's the one that did, just a whole bunch of them that are great, but there's a whole bunch that aren't
Nick
great.
Nick Toshes, who just passed.
There's a, so oh, I'm great. Sorry. I don't know who he was, but you can explain to me later. but most of the record companies have people that are not, really, they just make up this stuff. I mean,
it's everything is so different now than when we were hanging out with musicians.
I know, but I mean, seriously, these pop star things are all now are just and throughout history have just been what they want it to be.
What do you mean, made up? The stories about their lives?
They might have an ounce of truth in them. But, you know, they all died on drug overdoses, and maybe that's not true, and they all did this, and this happened to them, and that happened to them. And they're not really true. They just try to make people look like something that really weren't. Read some of your bios. Read a lot of this stuff.
I mean, I never read. It's weird. I don't ever read.
Well, do you
bio.
Do? I've seen some of them, and they're just really, just they're made up to make somebody look really good so you'll idolize them. They're not really, they're not factual. They're not like you write, Pamela.
Well, I thank you, Mercy.
So what I'm trying to say is history, you need to do the history because most of the history is bull.
Well, one of the reasons I do the rock tours is for that. People are very curious about what really happened, where it happened, and, you know, it's very fun, my rock tours. Sign up, everybody. Come on, I'm with the band Rock Tours. You can go to PamelaDeBar.com and do that.
Yes, and I wish people would follow Lindsay Parker because she's just a really talented girl, and she's, you know, she's got lots of things. She's got many interviews with.
She's on. She has a show with Michael DeBar.
Yes, she does. In fact, guess who they got on today?
Who?
I said, listen, you got to ask this guy this. Booker T.
Booker T. Yeah, I saw that.
I said
T.
you need to ask him first of all about the racial, if you can. Say you had a friend that was with Al Green in 1971. Don't say it's me, but tell about I had to get out of cars and that's how bad. Ask Booker T. about that, and then ask Booker T. about Watt Stacks, the thing that actually changed and gave the blacks a coliseum full of blacks that helped change the world and the black attitude towards. You know,
or Booker T and the MGs, you mean?
Well, no, Watt Stacks.
Oh.
Their own people, and he is part of that.
Yeah.
At the Coliseum had their own Woodstock. It was called the Black Woodstock. And it changed the way that the black movement was going to be more acceptive and just change, like the Staples Singers, all these different people changed the way everything was going, you know, and made them more aware of the whole universe rather than just the we are. It made him, first of all, it made him proud to be Black.
Yeah.
That was really important. It's really important, that concert.
What year was that?
God, you know, if I ever really knew. I can't figure out why I was there. I was there because, first of all, I'll be there anyway because of Stax, but I was actually the assistant manager to the Barclays, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, Albert King, and they were all on that.
Did you come to have that amazing gig?
And Carla Thomas. How did I? Okay. I was trying to get hold of Shuggie Otis. I wanted to be with Shuggie Otis. So I go get Carla Thomas, who sang with Otis Redding, his partner on Tramp and all that, was in town, and somehow I got a hold of her, and I had her set up to go on the Johnny Otis radio show.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a manager called Sandra Newman, one of the only white, probably, managers, and her people were Carla, Rufus, the Barclays, Albert King. And so she came with us to the Johnny Otis show, and I was trying to impress Shuggie.
Yeah.
Shuggie was there.
Oh. And how old was Shuggie at the time?
What, 16, 17? I don't know.
Yeah. So Mercy Robbed the Cradle.
Oh, come on. That's nothing compared to Jimmy Page and the 14-year-olds. Anyway, so...
That's true.
So anyway, we're at the radio station, and she goes to me, "How would you like to work for me as my assistant?" Sandra Newman said that.
Wow,
and
cool.
I said, "Oh, my God." And so I ended up working for the guys that I totally loved, the Barclays,
yeah,
who I followed, you know, everywhere. I knew one of them. And when I knew one of them, he was the only living survivor off the Otis Redding plane crash. The only one that lived.
Yeah.
And I say this, Otis, and she has it in her book. I would run around with Otis, that plane crash in my hand from Jet Magazine.
She carried the picture of Otis Redding around in her little purse or wallet. Of him frozen stiff to
in the co-pilot, strapped in the co-pilot seat. You know,
frozen
talk about strange
stiff
things.
With icicles coming off of him. I went, "Oh my God, Mercy."
So my friend, Ben Colley Jr., who only died about 2 years ago, and I saw him about five at Amoeba with, they came, some other group, Bow Keys came out here. And he was still talking about the plane crash.
God.
He never got over the Otis Redding plane crash. And he saw the Barclays, because Otis was strapped in, like I said, to the co-pilot seat. He wasn't going anywhere. He was gone. It was over for him. The rest of them floated to the top, and they were waving at him and saying, "Help me, help me." And they went down in front of him. And somehow he was saved, because I think he was sleepy when it hit and just woke up to it. And,
wow.
You know, and then I began working for him when he was young, and the new Barclays started. You know, because James Alexander was on another airplane. So he didn't die. So they started a new Barclays, who I loved, because they were like just total freaks. Total freaks. I mean, that Parliament, before Parliament.
Yeah.
Parliament kind of got stuff from the Barclays, who in turn, I think, really got stuff from Zoller X.
Oh, my God. Let's not go there.
No, it's actually interesting.
Okay.
No, I can give you some history.
Okay.
Zoller X came from Memphis. I didn't know that. I met him during punk.
Most people do not know the band Zoller X.
I know, but that's nice that they would know them. They should know them.
They dressed like space people.
Yes, they did in Memphis. Yes. You can imagine that in the 60s. So that's what the Funkadelics and the
Barclays. I remember Zoller X. They loved Michael DeBar. They loved Silverhead.
Well, that's so interesting. I saw what they were in who they were before the punks.
Yeah.
And I had no idea they were from Memphis. Then I got it.
Yeah.
I got it. That's where the Barclays And the Funkadelics and all those people.
So you think they Zoller X influenced
I'm
these
sure
people?
Did.
Wow! Because no one bought their records or anything.
No, but that had nothing to do with who they were. You know what they did in Memphis? Can you imagine them being in Memphis doing that in the late 60s?
Yeah, it was pretty far out.
Okay, so who's gonna see
Didn't
that?
We used to hang out with Zoller X.
I was real good friends with Weigar. He gave me some of his clothes.
His name was Weigar.
Yes, they were. He's still here. They were in the Canterbury.
What's that?
The Canterbury, we can get into pumpkin, really gives these people an education here. Okay. Canterbury was a hotel that everybody lived in.
Okay, let's go into the punk world. Mercy did hair for a lot of punk bands. Mercy's had many, many lives.
Okay.
So let's go
I
there.
Didn't know who to be after I came out of the Johnny Otis. I didn't know where to go or
okay.
what happened.
Let's nutshell this. She married Shuggy Otis, was very involved in the Johnny Otis world, had a son, Lucky Otis, who you've heard on my podcast already. So after that, after she came out of that situation, we're going into the punk thing, right?
Okay, what happened was I had a friend that Marlo brought called Shannon.
Marlo was a BTO, remember?
Yes. Should I get you a anyway, so...
Okay.
So Shannon was my friend, and she had come out here with Marlo, so Marlo introduced me to Shannon, and she took me to The Mask, which mm-hmm. I knew just started. The Mask is where all
Mask
punks
was a
started.
Club, punk club.
The punk club that started everybody. Very important. And if people leave LA, the truth is people leave LA out of the blues. They leave it out of the punk. LA is not a center of music. Even with Love, because they were from LA, they leave LA out of a lot of stuff, except for the Doors. But,
yes, yes.
But anyway,
well, the Birds.
So The Mask was the underground punk club, and she takes me there. Never heard of it. On the walls or stuff like Kill Niggers, Hate, all this white supremacy stuff. And I'm going, oh my God, what is this?
Anyway, very, the antithesis of what you believe.
Exactly, exact opposite, 10 years later. Yes. So anyway, she takes me, I ended up with Brendan Mullen. I went to bed with him, he was the best, and I told him this, he's dead now. He started punk.
That was her best sexual experience.
Besides Jerry Sikorsky, and he knows that in the Rockabilly Rebels, but that's okay. Anyway, so anyway, The Mask is the beginning of punk. Okay, I'm down there. Nobody knows who I am except for...
Who?
Don Bowles.
Don Bowles. He came to my last party.
Don Bowles, who was living with Weigar from Zoller X.
Okay.
Who had my album in there. Because I was going under the name...
Our album.
Our album. Sorry. Anyway, I was going under the name of Ravy Ravon.
Ravy Ravon.
Ravy from...
Amazing name.
Buddy Holly and Ravon from Revlon. I mean, you know.
R-A-V-E-E. Ravon was her name for a while.
And
how
I was
amazing
in, I
is
was
that?
In hair school, but I would go outside of hair school, and I found people to work on. I got the Gears, and they became my... I was a stylist for the Gears. And then... And Levi and the Rockettes came over here from... I hated punk.
England.
I did
England.
Not like punk, okay?
I'll try to finish some of her sentences.
I was not a big punk fan. I was not going for it. Even though I believe that punk really started at the Wilton Hilton. During 69.
What's the Wilton Hilton?
The Wilton Hilton was a very famous place. You've heard of it, haven't you? It's called the Wilton Hilton. You look it up on Wikipedia. It's there. And we lived there. So Doris... And Boris and Dolores, who I won't tell you really who they are, but that's the house we lived in. I would go downstairs in 69 to the basement, and I heard this stuff that I had never heard in my life. And I said, what is that? It was really punk.
And what
before
was it?
Punk. It was punk.
I know, but what band was it?
I can't tell you who they are. Doris, Boris, and Dolores. I can't give their real names because somebody wants to be hidden here. Okay.
Okay, but can you say the name of the band?
Doris, Boris, and Dolores.
Okay. All
that
right.
was her name. Anyway, so anyway, after we moved out, I went with Shuggy. She sold the house. And before that, Blondie was there. And then the Screamers moved in there. So that's where the beginning of punk really started. But anyway, let's go back and get the 79. I guess it was 75, 79, somewhere around there. I walk in.
How old was Lucky? That's where you can figure the time frame.
I don't know. I really don't know. 15, okay. 14, okay. 14, probably 14, 15.
Okay.
And say, okay, I start doing hair. So I get the Gears as my group that I'm styling. Okay. That's my main thing. Then a group, I'm in the first time I ever went to the Whiskey after. Being at the Whiskey with the GTOs and everything else.
We performed at the Whiskey.
Yeah. I go there later, 10 years later, with
The Consumers, which is Don Bowles from Arizona. Black Randy and the Metro Squad were there. You wouldn't know them, but these are all the real punks. Okay. And I'm going, this is absolutely hideous. The group I went with tried to strangle their lead singer, and I thought it was actually a game. I thought they were kidding, but they weren't kidding. They were really doing it. Okay. And I'm going, this is the ugliest thing I've ever, this is really hideous. The music's hideous. What's happened to the whiskey? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, in comes this incredible looking cat. They come walking in the door. They look, their suits are like, they were the Rockettes. They were Levi and the Rockettes. It was rockabilly. Okay, their hair was done perfectly. And I'm going, oh my God, we're saved. We are saved. So I walked up, to the guy with him, and first Levi says to me, who's from England, I go, oh, it would be England, because I couldn't stand England, because I thought they kind of ruined American music in a way, because they got rid of a lot of our artists when they took over the charts. I kind of had a, and they were bringing us back.
She didn't
stuff.
Like the Beatles, okay?
That's not the main thing. No, it had to do with the blues artists, how what happened. I know they brought it back, but they also took over their spots, all the R&B, except for Motown and Sax. You know, basically blocked out people as good as Gene Chandler. Some of our greatest artists got just...
And also some of the white people like Bobby Rydell and Dion. Yeah.
And I was kind of annoyed at, but they did bring it back, so I had to give... So when,
yes,
when Levi opens his mouth, he's English. And he goes, I want to play the Louisiana Hayride. First thing he says to me, and the guy with him goes, do you know who you're talking to? To Levi. And I said, he goes, I didn't know it was Lee Childers, who's very famous. Okay. Extremely famous. Yes. Very famous. He goes, you're talking to Miss Mercy of the GTOs, and I want you to know that. To Levi. And we became really close, and I started doing some of their hair.
She did the most outrageous, amazing rockabilly hairdos. You've never seen anything quite as good. I don't know how she
called.
She made them so tall, their hair. It was unbelievable.
Well, actually, it was called the spiked rockabilly. Because you could either do it either way. But anyway, so they actually did end up at the Louisiana Hayride. My friend Tom Harris that had the club with Rodney Bingenheimer, English disco that I never went to and could give a darn about it anyway.
I went.
Well, you went, but I didn't. Okay. But Lori and... No offense, Lori, but you guys... Sable was not very nice about us. I'm going off the deep end. Yes.
Okay. You're going back to the punk scene when you're doing hair, okay?
I got that. Why was I there?
We were just talking about how, you were involved in the punk world. You were right in the thick of it.
No.
And Darby Crash was your friend and all that stuff.
I got that, but I had the Louisiana Hayride. That's where I was at.
Okay.
Tom Ayers picks up, who was very close to me, picks up on what I'm doing, and we get Levi and the Rockettes to the Louisiana Hayride. It's like 1979 after they kicked it, kicked Elvis out. Can you imagine these? They were like 3/4 English. And two Americans. And they go to Louisiana Hayride. And I go to Shreveport, too. I end up going there, too. And we went to the Hayride. And they played that. It was crazy. But, okay, here's another scene that happened. It's kind of fun. When the Rockettes were playing here, the Mau Maus, another group with Rick Wilder, who's actually in the Weekends videos. I thought it was a woman, but it's Rick. It's crazy. No. Anyway... We were at the Troubadour, and he was getting ready to go beat the heck out of the Rockettes. They hated rockabilly. They were really against it because it was really bringing people to where it should be, you know, letting people get away from that punk, because punk was like a straight line up. You know, there was no beginning, and it went straight up, no bridge. It was like 45 seconds of whatever it was. Anyway.
Chaos.
Chaos, really, except for a few good ones. But
I like the Sex Pistols.
So here's the Mau. We're going to the really cute Mau Mau. I forgot his name. Okay, we're going to go up there. We're going to beat them, out of them on stage right now. And I said, wait a minute. I don't think you're going to do that because on the drums is Jerry Nolan from the Dolls. And they went, Oh, really? I guess we're not going to do that.
Wow, you saved the night.
It was funny.
Like you did probably many, many times in your life, honey.
But anyway, but the punk was amazing. That's where I met Steve Olson, the skateboarder who changed skateboarding. We kind of worked on it together. Steve Olson was up there with Tony Alva. And I met him at the other mask. And we started like the skateboard thing. So changing it from grunge to punk, because it was kind of good. Alva was kind of grungy.
Mercy, your stories are just
okay. That's enough about that.
Spectacular.
Spectacular. Well, thank you.
Okay, let's fast forward a little bit. Now, after you did all this wild shit, you got married to the wrong guy. But
excuse me?
No, after Shuggy. Wait.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no. I know Shuggy was the right guy to marry. Okay, I'm not
talking I dreamed.
She dreamed Shuggy and married him and all that.
I dreamed I married Shuggy and then I did marry Shuggy.
So
didn't even know him then.
So I'm talking about, not going to even say his name. So he, but he got you. The only good thing he did for you was get you a job at Goodwill.
Yeah, for 20 years.
And she has worked at Goodwill for 20 freaking years. That was a good thing he did for you, though.
Yeah, it was.
And he was a terrible asshole.
He also, we were on crack together. We lived homelessly, which I love because of Desolation Row. To me, that Bob Dylan song was, I wanted to live that Bob Dylan song.
And she did. For 7 years, she was homeless.
No, I wasn't. No, that's not true.
Well, okay, tell me.
I had apartments here and there. We had apartments, and we would just smoke ourselves out of them.
Yeah, well,
so I
remember one of the apartments on Wilcox.
The lady I lived with. We had apartments.
Oh, I was so worried about her. I would meet her every once in a while because I never, ever wanted to lose touch with her.
No, she was right there.
Even though she was a freaking
crackhead. Well, I never did.
Crackhead.
I became a crackhead because when I got here back from Lake County, I went to Lake County because my mother died. And then she died. And I would have to live with my sister.
She was really close with her mom.
Yeah. Was six. I went up to Lake County for about 4 years or something.
Yeah.
To get away from everything. I was losing my mind. I actually had a nervous breakdown. I stopped doing drugs. And you can't just stop drugs. You can't without coming down or, you know, going to rehab, which they didn't really have.
They didn't have
or
that
any thing. Help or anything. I just stopped them. And I wouldn't, between my mother dying and stopping drugs, I went into wherever that spiral is. It might even have had some of that when you had a baby and then you couldn't take care of the PM, whatever that thing.
PTSD.
It's not PTSD.
PMS?
No. Well, I might have had post-traumatic even back when that happened because my marriage fell apart. Whatever.
Yeah, everything happened at once.
So
yeah.
So anyway, I'm up there and why am I up there? Because I ran away from everything.
Yes, you went up to Lake County, but then you came back down and met the guy I'm not going to mention.
Okay, when I came back down, this whole place where I lived was Crackville. The Maralitas from Cuba had been sent over here by Castro, and they brought, you know, when he kicked them out of the country, that was 1980, whatever, they brought the crack. So when I got to where I was at, on Argyle, I moved to Argyle.
Yes. Yeah, I remember very well.
The whole from Cahuenga to Argyle was filled with 18th Street Gang before MS-13 came in. Okay, and the whole place was cracked up, every corner. So my ex-boyfriend Bernardo, I went and stayed with him too, had been a crackhead. I had missed all that because there was no crack up in Lake County. It was speed. I went back on meth up there, but there was no meth here, so I went back. I went on crack, and I went there for 8 years.
It was harrowing for her friends, especially me, you know. I would go find her literally under a bridge.
No, you never. You said Victor.
No, I came there once, too, and you were pushing a cart. She pushed a cart like a homeless lady.
Yeah, but I look good.
She did look good. She never, ever neglected her visual. I've got to say that right now. She always looked good.
But, yeah, I loved it. It was like Desolation Row. I would go to Skid Row and stay.
She has no regrets about being, you know,
except
semi-homeless for all those years. That's incredible.
My son basically was, well, he didn't. My son was basically with Otis's, but he would run away. The Peters family.
Her
followed
family.
The same.
Her family, Peters.
Probably the same thing. My sister disappeared at 15, got married. I disappeared at 15. My son, no matter where he was with the Otises, left that.
The Johnny Otis family.
Yeah, left that.
Yeah.
We just all rebelled at 15, which is typical.
Well, okay, now I'm going to fast forward a little bit because we're running out of time.
Okay.
You got clean 3 months before you started coming to help me take care of my mom.
I got clean, Rona, yeah. I got clean.
What got you clean?
What got me clean? I was living with, I was away from my husband because he beat my face in. And
yes.
That was an operation. This is all...
She has metal in her face because he punched her out. Okay. And we all can't stand that guy.
And he went, even though he got sober and got into Goodwill and I followed him, he got unsober. And I decided, I'm out. Yeah. So I'm out, away from him.
But she stayed sober.
No, I didn't get sober yet. I'm over at this house just to be away from him. And it was Thanksgiving Day. And I put my pipe the night before outside because the woman I lived with had... wanted nothing to do with that. Put my pipe outside by the trash cans. And the next day I went to go get my pipe and it was missing. And there was an AA meeting across the street. And I said, I'm done. And I walked into the AA meeting and that was it. It's not that I became an AA member and I went to NA, but I decided that it's really, if you're trying to get away from drugs, why sit there and listen to stories about them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the further I could get away from it, and it just worked. It's like...
She stopped. I remember it all so... I was so thrilled. And then 3 months later, my mom wasn't, you know, had become pretty sedentary. And I moved her into the house behind me. We had a guest house. And Mercy became her caretaker.
Well, you didn't move me in there because I still live with Leonard.
No. Yeah. I did. Oh. I moved my mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then Mercy came 3 days a week. And... got really close
sometimes
with my
longer
mom.
Because you would go on trips,
yeah, but she was there a lot anyway. She was my mom's other companion besides
and
I'm
me. Actually the one that said I hear something in her lungs,
yeah,
and we took her and then right out that's a sad story, but
well, she was with me when my mom passed. It was
were in the same room. She called me in. I was in the, yeah. sleeping in her bed and uh-huh. she said come on Mercy, and we just sat there and watched her take her last.
It was amazing.
It happened that fast. You know, but hospice came in. So
yeah, hospice came in.
Once they're in there, you got like 3 days.
But I remember her raising up. She was completely lifeless, right? I mean, on her way out. And at the last second, she sat up and put her arms out like that. Way up, like, and opened her eyes.
You must have saw that, and I didn't.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, probably right before I called you in. It was an amazing moment. But anyway, Mercy and my mom and I got... all very close together.
Yeah, it was
and it kept
fabulous.
Helped keep her sober.
Oh, really?
It's so great.
And I never drank. I was never an alcoholic because my father, he was an alcoholic and also an amphetamine taker, by the way. And a gambler.
And he killed himself.
And he committed suicide.
Yeah.
And he said goodbye to Rodney Allen Ripley and Morris the Cat. I don't know.
Well, he said...
But he constantly tried to kill himself. He was suicidal throughout.
Oh, my God.
He
what
just
a
wasn't treated.
History she's got.
Anyway, so... Where were we?
We're coming towards the end.
Yeah, right. And we were doing what?
We were talking about my mom and how you it helped keep you sober. To be
okay. So
taking care of my
surrounded
mom.
By morphine, and I didn't touch anything. I didn't touch it, and I never touched it. I did the same thing with cigarettes.
Anyway, 20 years now. She's 24 years. You've been sober, right?
I've been off street drugs. I went 10 total years without any drugs. And then, I had cancer twice, which.
Well, that's different when they're prescribed and they're part of your treatment.
Right. But so, I never abused them. I never,
yeah,
I had
she's
a,
sober,
I, had, I have a thing about it where I'm very careful about, I was very careful about what I took and when. You could leave me with a whole prescription bottle. And, you know, if it was a bottle of speed, it'd be gone in 3 days.
Yeah.
I'd put it all in a syringe and just, okay.
Whatever. Well, I think our time is up, sweetheart.
Don't say that.
No, I mean, for today.
Yes, it is.
For today. because I really want to have Mercy as my sidekick on, you know, more occasions, because there's still
we're good together.
Well, there's still so much more to talk about. I mean, my God, we barely touched it again. I mean, how long have we been hanging out? 50 years. 52 years.
Ridiculous.
That's insane, right? I know. But anyway, thank you for being here, Mercy. I love you more than anything in this world.
Well, I love you more than anything my other half. And I really appreciate everybody here. I can put you in.
Pantheon!
Can you say their names?
Sure, go ahead.
Aaron and Jerry.
Yes, our team.
Our team.
Our Pantheon team.
For real.
Well, anyway, Mercy, thank you again, and we'll do this again.
Yes, and look for my book, Permanent Damage, co-authored by the great Lindsay Parker, which should be, we hope, out in this year sometime.
Yes, 2020.
Yeah, we're at the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Ciao, Manhattan.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that dog is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor...
Okay, how was that? There's very few people in this world who could tell a story like Mercy does, is there? And you know, it's so cool to talk about Graham. I'm going to Nashville next week to celebrate him again. I often speak at his, you know, like festivals, memorials and things. So it was great to remember some of the great stuff about Graham with Mercy. And also, she is writing a book. Mercy's book is almost finished, and you're going to be so lucky to read it. So that was amazing. Thank you, Mercy. I love you so much. I love her so freaking much. Okay, dolls. I hope you tune in to all my different podcasts. And until next time, I am Miss Pamela, and you've been listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party. And you know, you can keep up with everything I do at my website, PamelaDeBar.com. And my words of wisdom this week is to dance, okay? Dance. Go out there and dance. Find a club nearby you and hear some live music and move your damn feet to the beat.
Listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, produced by Aaron Alden and Christian Swain. All sound design by Jerry Danielson and Busy Signal Studios. Find Miss Pamela at Pamela DeBar on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Find all the Pantheon podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you find great podcasts. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/pantheonpodcasts, Rock and Roll Archaeology on Instagram, and Pantheon Pods on Twitter.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only. right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.